This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pravnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. Thank you to everyone listening to us here on Sirius 220, XM 206, and check out the website as well for live shows and replays at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides permanently disabled riders who have given everything to the sport, provide them with so much. If you are able to help, please visit the website pdjf.org. Now this evening we have a very special guest. Quite frankly, she is my hero. She helped pave the path for future women jockeys such as myself. She was the first female jockey to win a pari-mutuel race in the United States. It is an honor to introduce to you jockey Barbara Jo Rubin. Barbara, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So great to have you here, Barbara. And you mentioned prior to going on air that most folks call you BJ. So
that's correct.
So from now on here on the show, I'll be referring to you as BJ. And of course, I know you're good friends with PJ Cooksey. And
yes.
Quick question, was wondering, is that BJ, did that help you when you rode? Did you often go by that in the program? So folks didn't really know you were a female rider?
No, I went by Barbara Jo back then.
Okay. And then... Gosh, I can't imagine everything you must have had to go through, Barbara. And so can't wait to hear your story. And like I said, the way we usually start these shows, we go back and go back to the beginning. And tell us about growing up.
Well, growing up, I always had a love of horses. You know, when I was, I could just barely walk. I wanted to go to the pony rides. I just wanted to be around them. Follow them. I just had pictures everywhere pasted in my room, which my sister didn't like because she was a ballet dancer. So I loved them, but our family didn't have a lot of money. So the most I could do was go to some of the pony rides, but I could never own a horse. And then I contracted polio at age 6 before the salt vaccine came out.
Wow.
And so I was at Children's Variety Hospital in Miami, Florida. And while I was there doing my therapy and all, I was not allowed to see my parents because we were in quarantine section. It was the only hospital taking polio victims. Mm-hmm. And they would tie my feet in these shoes that were nailed to a wall to keep my legs straight. So I had to stay like this just about 24/7 unless I was doing therapy.
Wow.
Well, they tried doing the water therapy with me. I was in there about 6 months, and they tried doing water therapy. I kept sinking. I could not swim. So they suggested when I did get out to go ahead and put me on a horse. Let me start doing English riding to help stretch the muscles in my legs. And so I thought polio was a godsend.
Wow.
I thought it was the greatest thing in the world that I got to ride horses finally. So I got to exercise saddlebreds. So I started my lessons out at 3 days a week, and that's all my parents could afford back then. And that was my start with my riding.
That's incredible, BJ, the way something so bad, such as polio, turned into something really, really good. It introduced you to riding, And I can't imagine as a kid, you said 6 years of age, you couldn't see your parents. Your legs are strapped to the wall for 6 months. I can't imagine how hard that must have been to go through that. That's incredible.
Yeah, the therapy was bad because they had to stretch your legs and the epidurals and, you know, all that was bad. But I used to lay in bed and daydream and have my legs up and pretend I was riding.
Wow.
So it was always oriented to the horse.
Right. It was meant to be, BJ. It was meant to be. So you started exercising saddlebreds, and how did your skills develop? Did you have a good teacher along the way?
I just was a natural. I just took right to it. I never had a problem. I was always top of my class. Everything was great. And then later on, my grandfather got a pony up here in Illinois. And every summer we'd come up here, and I'd just stay on a horse from morning till night.
Wow. It worked out well. Your grandfather got a pony.
Yeah, and I started actually training horses at the age of nine. I'd start training ponies how to bow and lay down and, you know, I'd race my ponies out in the pasture, stuff like that. And back then, I had always wanted to be a jockey. I thought, oh, man, this is the neatest thing, running full speed on these ponies. Of course, I had no saddle, so I was always bareback. And I just thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And then I saw the National Velvet, the movie. And from then on, I thought, that's what I'm going to do. So I knew it very early that I eventually was going to be a rider.
Wow. Now, did you have any introduction to racing prior to watching the movie National Velvet? Did you go to the racetrack? Did you know exactly what a jockey did at that young age?
No, I didn't. But when I was about 14, we were at this ranch in Miami where everybody put their horses. I did get a pony. He was a wild one at a pony ring and run off with everybody. They couldn't stop him. So I ended up getting him and training him, and everybody saw what a good rider I was. So then we started going to the people at the farm. They would take horses to these match races. And they started putting me on these horses to run the match races because I was little and I was a girl, and everybody thought I'd fall off, so they'd bet more money on my horse. So they were able to make a lot of money, and, of course, I was happy just riding. I'd get paid in, you know, lunch and ice cream.
Wow.
That was it.
That's too funny. And you were how old at this age when you were riding match races?
When I was doing the match races, I was about 13 or 14.
Wow, so young. What did your parents think? I mean, given your health history, they had to be somewhat concerned, and you're riding these,
they just knew I wanted to be out there riding, so they would drop. They didn't know a lot of it because they would drop me off at the farm on like Friday night, pack my lunch, and then bring lunch out to me the next day, and I'd just sleep there in one of the stalls with horses. And I'd stay there all weekend, and then they'd pick me up Sunday afternoon. It was my mother mostly. My dad was always away.
So they didn't really see the maybe the crazy horses you would
nope.
you would ride. So they didn't know about
it
that.
It was only when I got hurt, you know, like something would happen and I would get hurt, and then I would try to hide it because I didn't want them to know, you know, when I split my head open or something, like when a horse, you know, ran into a pole or things like that.
Wow.
I tried to hide as much as I could because I thought, well, they won't let me ride anymore.
Right. Well, you know. That's crazy. Now, how about this? I heard something about rodeo. You got into rodeo?
Oh, yeah. I used to rodeo. I think I was 16 or 17 when I started the rodeo. And I used to love to go to Davie, and they used to practice the bull riding. And all the guys would be getting on, and a lot of them, there was a couple mean bulls there, and the guys would go, oh, we're not going to get on this one. He's bad. And I'm like, you guys are such pusses. I said, I could ride that thing. They're like, no, you can't. And I'm like, yes, I can. So they put me on, tied me down. I'd never done it before, and I rode the bull out.
Wow.
Well, then they were all pissed because I rode the bull out and showed them up. Mm-hmm. So then they said, well, you can't do that again. And I'm like, well, it was pretty easy the first time. I guess I can. So they tied me on, opened the gate. When the bull came out, he just took off at a dead run.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, I looked back, and all I could see was this broomstick stuck in his ass. They went ahead, and they thought, well, they were going to fix me, so they put this broom in his butt. When they opened the gate, well, he took off full speed across the arena, tail straight up, and when I looked back, I had to laugh because I saw this broom sticking out. And I was like, oh, my God. And then he stopped. At the end, I went over his head, but I was still hung up in the rigging. Oh. Well, then he started twirling around and stomping me. Then all the cowboys, I guess, got nervous thinking that I was going to get killed, and they all ran out to help me. When they ran out to help me, one of them got a shoulder broke. One broke his arm. I got free. I only had a lot of, I guess I had a lot of hoof prints all over my legs, and I had gore marks in my back, but I still wasn't going to tell my mom.
Oh, my gosh. How did you hide that?
Well, I hid it for a day. She saw I was walking funny, and then she came in when I was getting up the next day, and I was really sore. So she came in and saw all the marks on my back and then my legs, and she was, like, terrified. She's like, what did you do? And I go, oh, I just had a little accident. It's okay. It's okay. But I only did it a couple more times because she said if she caught me doing it, then I wouldn't be allowed to ride anymore.
Oh, no. Well, then, yeah, better put a stop to that. Better put a stop to that, BJ.
Pardon?
I have to say that might be the funniest story I've ever heard. The
broomstick
in his
ass. It was.
Wow.
But I was always a tomboy. I just wanted to try and outdo the guys in anything I did.
And you showed them, and you showed them many different times in racing later on. But we'll get to that, BJ. And how did you transform from riding bulls and riding in match races to then going to the racetrack?
Well, I wanted to be a vet, but, of course, we had no money. I started into junior college in Broward, and I was so bored. All I dreamed about was horses, and I daydreamed. I thought, this is not for me. I cannot sit in a classroom. So my cousin, who was Robert Burns, he was a lawyer in Miami. He owned racehorses, and he had 10 racehorses with Dave Harper down at Tropical Park. And I called him up, and I said, I want to be a jockey. And he's like, well, I can take you out to my trainer, and you can start getting on horses. So I went to Tropical Park with him and my father, and when we went there, the trainer's like, absolutely not. She doesn't know anything. We girls don't really gallop. There was only one other gal galloping on the track, and her husband was a trainer. He says, no, she can't do this. He said, well, then I'm taking all my horses away from you if you don't let her learn. And it was a pretty big stink there.
I'm sure.
So they had a little fight, and then he agreed to let me get on a horse. So they put me on one, took me to the track. They said, well, tie across. Well, I didn't know anything. I didn't know what tying across was, AC Ducey, you know, how you fix your irons. I didn't know anything. I just went ahead and, like, I can do this. And luckily, the pony stayed with me, and we went around one time, and they told me to just stay up off their back. And after I did a mile with the pony, I'm like, oh, my God, I really don't know what I'm doing. It was pretty hard on the legs because you have to be pretty fit to ride.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
So we went back to the barn, and the trainer agreed to let me come in the barn every day and work. And I would go in at 4:30 every day, travel to Tropical Park, and I'd go in there, and I would work from 4:30 until like 10:30 every morning. And my pay was to get on one horse or pony a horse. And if I got on one horse, it was usually I could get on one going around the shed. They wouldn't really let me get out on the racetrack with it.
Really?
And so they actually, my license was a hot walker, nothing else.
Oh, wow.
So I worked all summer like that, and then the trainer was going to be going up to New England, and they were going into Suffolk Downs. And so I decided I'm going with the track, and I'd never been away from home except for going to my grandparents every summer. So I decided I was going, and I started, you know, galloping myself one horse a day. And then I started getting on two horses because he saw that he didn't have to pay me and so that he didn't have to pay exercise rider either, so he could save money. So then he started letting me get on more. Well, the more horses I got on, the better I felt. So then when I would get done at his barn, I would run and start catching horses for other people that would let me. Most of the people would not let me come under the shed row. Wow. They were like, no, this is bad luck, and they'd yell at me and make me get out of the shed row, even when I was running from one place to the other.
No.
And I didn't have any money back then because I wasn't getting paid. So he started letting me use the pony in the afternoon to take horses to the post, which was, I made, I think, $5 to take a horse to the post. So mm-hmm. I could use the pony, and that's the only money I had to pay for my room because we weren't allowed to stay on the racetrack. And there was another girl that was a hot walker, and we took the room together at mm-hmm. Revere Beach. Mm-hmm. Then one morning, the only thing we could do for breakfast was we'd go to the kitchen and sit there, and when people were done, we'd finish their plates.
No
so that's
way.
How we got our food.
Wow.
And one morning at in Boston, it was storming, and there was hail coming down, and Bill Saravo was going from barn to barn and said, I need somebody to breeze this horse because we've got a race coming up, and I've got to blow him out. And I said, well, I'll do it. And he says, well, he's a tough horse. I said, that's okay. I can gallop a tough horse, which I really didn't know enough. Mm-hmm. So he put me on the horse. I went out there. The hail was hitting this horse so hard in the face that he wouldn't take off with me. We just did a nice breeze. He came right back and pulled up, and he's like, I've never had that horse go so good. You want a job?
Oh, wow. The hail worked out.
I had to tell him, well, I'm not as experienced as you think, but I'm willing to learn.
Absolutely.
So that was my first pay job.
Wow, the hail worked out. That
so it was pretty
crazy.
Exciting. And I was my dream was starting to come true. And the more horses I got on, the better I got. And then people started watching me. And they would see me, you know, galloping horses and breezing horses. And a lot of people wouldn't tell me, you know, if I was doing right or wrong. They didn't want to give me too much information. So I would just watch. And then every afternoon I'd go and sit by the gate and watch how the horses would break. And then I sort of devised my own system for breaking. Mm-hmm. And then it got to be winter time. And when it was winter, Saravo wanted me to stay and go to Lincoln Downs. Well, it was so cold, and I was a Florida girl. And I'm like, I just can't do this. My hands froze on the reins. The mask froze on my face. I couldn't get off the horse because my legs felt like they were going to break. So I'm like, I've got to go to Florida. And before Brian Webb went to Florida to Tropical Park, he had watched me galloping, and he offered me a job. And I said, well, the only way I'd go down is if you let me ride. And he just sort of laughed at me. Well, when it got too cold to be there, I called him up, and I said, well, I'm going to come to Florida. I'll take that job. And I said, but I am going to ride. And he says, yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay, he said.
Yeah, like, okay, yeah, really, you're going to ride. But he wanted me to work for him, so it sort of ended there on the conversation. I got to Florida in 2 days, and then I started working for him. Well, the second day I was there, I walked into the office, and I went to fill out my application, and I put apprentice jock instead of exercise rider.
Oh.
And they looked at me, and they go, you've got this wrong. You've got to circle exercise rider. I said, no. I'm going to be a jockey. I want my apprentice jockey's license. And they laughed at me. They go, you're crazy. You can't get that. So they went ahead. I filled out for an exercise license. Yeah. After I filled out my exercise license, I went back to the barn. And I'm like, they wouldn't let me, you know, go ahead and get my apprentice license. And Brian just sort of looked at me. Well, then, because I went in, the news sort of got hold of this. And I can't remember her name now, from the American Civil Liberties Union got a hold of me. And this lady came out and she says, we are going to get this pushed through. They cannot deny you a license. In the meantime, Kathy Kushner was in Maryland. And when she was in Maryland, they asked her, you know, she had the same problem. They denied her a license. So she went ahead and went to court first. And they said under the American Civil Liberties Act, they could not deny her a license.
Right.
So then as soon as they said she could get a license, I went back in and applied again for my apprentice license. And so they said, well, yeah, you can go ahead and get your license now. Well, then we were starting to go to court, too, here in Florida. And they said, well, it's up to, you know, the racing commission and the stewards and all this. So it was still, they weren't going to let me ride.
Wow.
So I had to wait about a month and a half. In the meantime, Kathy couldn't ride because she also rode the jumpers. She was a three-time Olympian.
Wow.
And one horse went down with her and broke her leg. So she was out. So then I went ahead and I waited a month and a half and I went before the racing commission. And it was huge in this room. And they kept asking me, well, why do you want to do this? And I kept telling them, this is my lifelong dream. Said, I can gallop just as good as the boys. I can work horses as good as the boys. I break on top. They said, well, if this is what you really want to do, we cannot stop you.
Right.
Because of the Civil Liberties Act. So I went, okay. So then they had me go back to the track, and I had to work for the stewards from the gate about three times. Each time I worked with journeyman jocks, and I outbroke them. I was straight. They could not deny anything. Then I had to do three works down the track. And they worked me short. They worked me two long works. Each time, they couldn't deny anything I was doing because I never made a mistake. So they said, we are going to have to, you know, go ahead and let you ride. So Brian named me on a horse the last day at Tropical Park. And it was Stoneland. So he named me on this horse. Jockeys came from New York. The union came. Everybody was there the day I was supposed to ride. Everybody's taking pictures with me. The jocks were congratulating me, you know, on, oh, have a good ride. And they had a trailer set up just to the back of the jockey's room where they would go outside. And before I was supposed to go in and ride, somebody threw a brick through my trailer window.
No.
And it came from the jockey's room. I guess they were trying to deter me. Well, that just got me mad. It didn't deter me at all. So then it got about time for my race. We were four races away. All the jocks boycotted.
No.
They said they would not ride another race. And since it was four races before, it was a record-breaking crowd at Tropical Park. Ed Pons was the owner at the time. And he said, we're going to have to take her off. If they would have boycotted my race, we were going to do a walkover, break from the gate, and I could ride my race, and that would be it.
Yeah.
But because they did it four races before, the crowds were getting angry. They wanted to bet. They were starting to tear things down, so they did take me off my horse.
I did not get
to ride that day.
Oh, my goodness.
But because there was so much press and there were so many people with this record-breaking crowd, then when I went home that night, I got a phone call, and it was from the president of the track over in the Bahamas. And over there, they raced, I think it was either two or three days a week. I can't remember now. And they invited me to come over and ride there. So their track was a member of the American Racing Association, but not in the United States. So I'm like, sure, I'll come over and ride there. I don't care.
Bahamas, too. Come on now.
Yeah. So it was the next week. I got my tack, got everything together, and I went over to Nassau. And when I went to Nassau, my visa wasn't quite in order, and they said, well, we want you to watch the races here. Well, I noticed when we were going into the track that these ponies were all tied out, staked out to eat grass along the road, and I'm like, oh, well, that's different. And when I got to the track, they said, oh, no, those aren't ponies. Those are the racehorses. I'm like, oh, okay, they're a little smaller over here.
Like a little bit different.
And they said, well, we want you to watch the films before you do actually ride a race, mm-hmm. because it's a little different over here. All the jocks go to the rail. And I go, well, they do that in the States, you know, when they're clear. And they go,
right.
No. They come out of the gate with the head sideways, and they go to the rail. So you either break on top or you pull up, and then go on.
Wow.
I went, okay. That doesn't bother me. So anyway, I had to go back to the States because my visa was not done correctly. And so they wanted me to come back. So I went back, I think, 4 days later. And it was a record-breaking crowd. I think I went off 1 to 10 that day because everybody bought a ticket just to have a ticket.
Sure,
the boys,
yeah.
A lot of the boys couldn't afford boots, so they would wear these black socks and just pull them up and to look like the boots.
No.
So they didn't have a lot of money over there, but they invited me to ride, and I wasn't going to miss it. So then on race day, you know, I was always very relaxed. I just went out, got on my horse in the, you know, in the paddock when they said riders up, got on my horse, went in the post parade, and I was always good out of the gate. I could break 1-2. So I broke on top, and I just stayed. And I won the race there in Nassau.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, since it was the last day that I was supposed to ride, they went ahead. My boss went with his string of horses. He went with me to Nassau, but then he left and went on to Pimlico Racetrack, where mm-hmm. they were going to be stabled. And he went there. So as soon as I rode the race, then I got on a plane and flew up to Pimlico. And then I started working there. So Brian wanted to put me on a horse at Laurel. And a few things happened that weren't supposed to happen. And I got very upset because I was disillusioned. You know, I thought, you know, I don't need these guys making passes at me and doing this stuff.
Right.
So I decided to leave. So I went to Arkansas. Well, when I went to Arkansas to the racetrack there, Brian was naming me on at Laurel the next day. So I just took off. I was like, no, I'm not putting up with this nonsense.
BJ?
So I went to Arkansas. Well, when I went there, I happened to hear all the jockeys saying, well, it's a good thing she's here. Now somebody can get her pregnant. We don't have to worry about her. Well, that
wow.
is the wrong way. So then I just went, got on a plane the next morning, went back there, apologized. And I think it was that next day, then Diane Crump rode at Hialeah.
Wow.
And then Brian named me on a horse at Charlestown Racetrack. So then I rode at Charlestown, and that was the first race that I rode in the United States.
BJ, let's talk about that after a quick commercial break. We'll continue our visit with jockey barber Joe Rubin after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. Jose Ortiz had a solid week at the Spa as he finished in the money on 57% of his mounts and led North America in earnings with almost $850,000, Ortiz finished the week with 6 wins, 11 seconds, and 8 third-place finishes. Monmouth Park leading rider Paco Lopez won 2 stakes over the weekend, highlighted by a win in the Grade 3 Molly Pitcher Stakes aboard Genre. Lopez tied Irad Ortiz Jr. for most wins in North America with 11 and added 3 seconds and 2 third-place finishes. Del Mar leading rider Flavion Pratt continued his hot streak as he won the Bing Crosby aboard Lord Nelson. Pratt has now gone back-to-back in the Bing Crosby as he won his first Grade 1 in the 2015 edition aboard Wild Dude. Pratt finished the week with 6 wins, 5 seconds, and 3 third-place finishes. Finally, the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Jersey Joe Bravo, had a monster week at the Spa and on the shore as he won 4 graded stakes at the 2 tracks. Bravo took the Vanderbilt Handicap aboard AP Indian on Saturday and then returned to Monmouth on Sunday to complete the graded stakes triple. Bravo finished the week with 6 wins and 1 second from 10 mounts. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, explores everything that goes into winning a race from the rider's perspective. How do jockeys land mounts? How did they plan strategy? What are jockeys thinking and trying to do as a race unfolds? The book answers those questions and many more. A significant portion of the proceeds go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. For excerpts, testimonials, and to order, visit JockeyTalk360.com. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at JockeyTalk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Barbara Jo Rubin. BJ, we were just talking before the break about how you went to Charlestown, and you were just beginning that story, so please continue.
All right. I was named on a horse at Charlestown, so we stabled at Pimlico Racetrack, and night racing was there at Charlestown. And so I was named on a horse, and it was Cohesion. It was Lawson's horse. And so I went down there the day before to look at the track because I wanted to see what the track was. I'd never ridden there. It was only a three-quarter. So I went there, looked at the track, talked to a couple of the leading jocks, and they said, oh, the minute that cold hits you on the back, freeze on the reins and fall off. And I'm like, all right, well, you guys stay on. And they go, yeah, but it's a lot harder than you think, sweetie. So I'm like, well, okay. So I just sort of took in everything they said in stride. I went and looked where I was going to change, which would have been the first aid room because I had no jocks room.
Of course.
And then I went on back to Pimlico because I still had to work all morning. And I had to do all the tack for the barn because I was under contract. Back then, we had to be under contract to ride. So Brian Webb took my contract for $75 a week, so I had to work all the horses. He had 25 horses in his barn. There were a couple other riders at work, but I got on the majority. I had to clean all the tack, do the pony in, do everything.
My gosh.
So after our work in the morning, they took me back up to Charlestown to ride that night. Well, I went in the first aid room after I got my license the previous day that I was there. I went into the first aid room, laid down, and went to sleep because I thought, man, I got to get some rest. I'm tired. And I wasn't nervous at all.
No.
So they came in, woke me up, walked me out, put me on the scale, and then I had to walk into the paddock. And the paddock was underground. It was in, like, the basement. It was a little different than what it is now. And so I went ahead and got up. I went to walk out. Well, I couldn't get through the crowd. There were so many people packed in this paddock, you couldn't get out. So they had to have 2 state troopers escort me to my horse because I couldn't get through the crowd.
Wow.
So they escorted me through the crowd. I went to the paddock. Brian gave me instructions on my horse, but I had already read the racing form, so I knew exactly how the horses were going to run in the race or had a good idea. So he put me up on my horse, and I went out. people were yelling. You know, some guys were yelling at me to go home. I had no business there. Jockeys' wives were yelling at me to get off the track. I had no business there. And then there were some people that were rooting for me. Well, as soon as I hit the track, I just blanked everything out, started talking to my horse, and I thought, I know how I'm going to ride this race. I knew that Kathy Kiley was the one to beat, and I knew that she always went wide coming into the home stretch. So we would break in front of the grandstand, go around, because it was only a three-quarter-mile track, and we were running 6.5. So I just broke on top like I usually do. I did have a running mate, so it was an entry. And that was really big, and I think Larry Kunitaki was riding the other horse. So when my horse broke from the gate, we were two on top. I went into the first turn, and I just started settling my horse. On the backside, Kathy Kiley went to the lead, and I'm not sure if it was really big that was running with him, with Kathy Kiley. Well, I just sat back there chilly, so I was racing, I think, third. As soon as we were starting to come to the final turn for the stretch, I knew Kathy Kiley would go wide and take really big out. As soon as she went wide, I went through on the rail just like I was planning, and I ended up winning the race. So it was pretty exciting, and I was just so excited the whole time I talked to my horse. Not hardly any whip. Most of my horses did better with this hand riding. Mm-hmm. So it was a wonderful race. They pulled up, went back to the winner's circle, got off my horse, and I was ready for bed.
Oh, you had to be exhausted. My gosh.
It was so cold. It really was cold.
What was the crowd's reaction when you crossed the wire in front? Here, half of them before the race are going, go home, make babies, and then you win the race.
A lot of people were cheering for me and yelling because I guess it had made history riding the first horse, you know, to win, first girl to win in the United States. So a lot of people were really cheering. There were still a lot that were booing and wanted me to go home. And the jockeys' wives still did not like me.
No, they still didn't like you. Oh, no.
And now, I guess they thought that I was going to be in the room with their husbands.
Oh, okay.
You know,
so
I don't
worried.
Know what the thing was, but they did not want me to ride.
Wow.
And I was like, afterward, I was just so happy, you know. I was like, okay, now I'm ready to go to bed. I rode my race.
And
then I kept thinking, God, what's the big deal? They didn't want me to ride. I broke from the gate. I could think about what I was doing. I knew what I was going to do during the race. I did nothing wrong, and I'm like, you know, why don't they want me to ride? And I think it was just because of tradition all those years, you know, hundreds of years, that the boys
sure.
were the jocks. There
yeah.
weren't girls out there.
No, that's the way it always been.
And they just thought, well, I couldn't handle the horse. I was going to get him in trouble. Yet I proved everybody wrong.
Get that.
So then after that, I went to Brian named me on a horse at Pimlico. And my first race there, I think it was in the mud. And so my race at Pimlico, I still had a lot of people booing and, you know, not wanting me to ride. And I don't remember the exact race, but I know I won it, and it was a long shot. And it was in the mud. So I just did the same thing. I sat chilly, you know, and I waited for my, you know, my spot to run. And my horse ended up winning the race. So it was a great race. And then the next race I rode was on a 60-to-1 shot, and that was there at Pimlico. And I was in a photo finish and beat by a nose. So it was pretty exciting. So then people started accepting me. Mm-hmm. The only bad thing was I was under contract. So I really had to do what my contract holder said. If I didn't do what my contract holder said, then he said I wasn't riding, and he would take me off, and I still had to just exercise horses and do the barn work. So then he had a friend in New York, which Brian Webb could not run in New York. He was ruled out. So he had a friend, Buddy Jacobson, which was the head of the HBPA, and he was a big trainer in New York. So Brian shipped a horse to New York and ran it under Buddy Jacobson's name. And this was at Aqueduct. And it was a first-time starter, Bravey Galaxy. She was a two-year-old, or she might have been a three-year-old. I can't remember right now. So anyway, I was supposed to ride there, and all the jocks, there were only a couple jocks that were, you know, that congratulated me and wanted me to ride, and Angel Cadero ended up being a real good friend of mine, and he looked out for me. And he, you know, when I was practicing or, you know, in the morning, we would go and we would make imaginary races, and he would say, Barbara Joe, what would you do if this happens? What would you do if this happens? And so he was really a good friend, and he helped me a lot as far as knowing what to do in situations.
That's
and so then when I rode Bravey Galaxy, she went wire to wire, and I think she paid like $14 or $16. And after I ran that race there, it was for Buddy Jacobson. He wanted my contract. He said, you can stay here in New York. You can ride my whole string. I don't know whether he had 35 horses. He had a big barn, a lot of good horses. And he wanted to keep me in New York and let me ride his full string because I was an apprentice, too.
Right.
But Brian would not turn loose in my contract.
Oh, my gosh.
So then I went ahead and went back to Pimlico, worked horses there, and then I think it was a day later, named me on another horse in New York. So then I went back to New York and rode, I think it was Fly Away. I can't remember. No, Fly Away was the one I rode in Nassau. But anyway, the horse I was supposed to ride there, we broke from the gate. It was a nice race, and I thought that, you know, I had a good shot to win that one. And Bobby Essery was right next to me. He cut right in front of me. I hit his horse, almost clipped heels, and I had to pull my horse up a little bit, you know, to keep from going down. And I didn't win that race. I think I finished third. Well, Angel stuck up for me, and after the race, he was yelling at Bobby, like, why do you hurt that little girl? She didn't do nothing to you. She rides her own race. So he was sort of sticking up for me.
Good. Good.
And then I rode another race and won that one.
Wow.
So I think I won my first 7 out of 11 races.
I have a statistic here. Barbara says 11 out of your first 22 starts. So that's even...
That might be right.
That's pretty incredible. That is a really good win percentage.
So long ago.
But that's incredible. And to show these people that I can't imagine... just getting up every morning and even with all the naysayers and people who are trying to put you down, you just kept at it every single day, and it finally paid off. And that had to be just an incredible feeling to be doing so well after you know, so much work and effort you put into it. And I remember, BJ, we were talking the other day, actually. You said you almost... had a mount in the 1969 Kentucky Derby. So
right.
tell me about that.
I was named on Picnic Fair, but he broke down, so I didn't get to ride it.
Gosh, so close, so close. Tell me about that horse. How did you get to that point?
Well, because I had been winning and doing so good, the man decided he wanted me to ride the horse. You know, and he was, I guess, one of these that wanted to buck the system, too.
Sure.
But it never came about because the horse broke down.
Ah, so close.
But I went to a lot of different racetracks because being under contract, Brian got paid $1,000 a performance for me to go places. So they shipped me all over the country, and whatever open horses were there, I got to ride.
Wow, he was making out pretty well with that deal, wasn't he?
Well, not really, because I didn't get paid for any of the mounts I rode for Brian.
Oh, sure, sure.
I just got paid my contract fee.
Sure.
And then a lot of these places, well, I still did good, you know, riding some of them. When I went to Canada, though, I got Assiniboia Downs. I got named on some horses that were not nice horses. They were ruled out of the States, and nobody wanted to ride them, so I got put on them. And that's when I started getting hurt. I had one horse break through the gate. Then they put me back into the gate, and it cracked my knee. So when they put me back in the gate, they were getting ready to spring it, and the horse did a half flip, got me under him in the gate, and was on top of me. Well, they pulled me out from under the gate. I got back on the horse, and then they sprung it. But I was really in pain then.
I'm sure.
And I think that was the last horse I rode there. I had three mounts. I think I won on one. So I had three mounts to ride there that night. But when I came back, I could not even gallop for a couple of days because my knees were so swollen from, you know, the horse breaking through the gate and then getting on top of me. And I had torn some cartilage, and everything was really bad.
Oh, my gosh.
So anyway, I shipped around different places, riding different places. I had to do a lot of appearances because they were paying me to come in and speak because, you know, I was the first woman and they wanted me to speak. It was silly at some of these assemblies where they had maybe 1,000, 1,500 people, and I'm like, why am I talking? I don't have any business up here talking. I just want to be a jock. So it was really hard to stay right at the track I wanted to be at, working every day. People wanted to put me on horses, but then I get shipped off to go do a parade, to go do a personal appearance, to get on a TV show, because I was on a lot of TV shows. I was on, to tell the truth, Joe Garagiola, Kraft Music Hall, Mike Douglas, Merv Griffin. I don't know. There was so many.
That's crazy.
And I really didn't want to do them because then it took away from my riding time.
Sure.
Or else they'd name me on a horse. Well, I couldn't ride the horse because I was going to be out of town.
That had to be frustrating.
And that part of it I did not like, but I had to do.
Goes along with being the first female jockey to win a race, I suppose. That's just incredible, BJ, and all that you've accomplished is incredible. How long did you ride for?
I only rode for not even a year because then after I got hurt real bad there, then I had a horse go down with me. I had several. I had like 14 falls in 2 weeks.
Wow.
You know, just on horses that were bad. And so then everything was bad. My cartilages were torn in my knees, and I kept telling Brian, you know, I've got to lay off a little while I'm in so much pain. So then they would give me painkillers, and they'd wrap my legs up so that I could ride. And I go, I can't ride like this. I can't think. I've never done any painkillers. I've never drank nothing. I said, I just can't do this. And he's like, well, then you're not going to ride anything. I said, well, I just need a break. I need to let my legs heal. I need to sit back. I didn't want to do the operations. I wanted to just try and heal myself up. And I just didn't like the way I was feeling on all the stuff they had me on. So then I went ahead and I took a break. And he was mad that I took a break, but I could hardly walk. My legs would give out when I'd walk. Mm. So I said, I'm taking the break. So I think I took like about 4 months or 5 months off. I started exercising, getting fit again. My legs were feeling better. I still had to wrap my knees, but I was feeling so much better, you know, not being on any drugs, no painkillers, nothing. And I said, okay, I'm ready to start riding again. I started getting fit. I started breezing horses. I went back to the track to Brian, and I'm like, okay, I'm getting ready to ride. And so he was going to name me on a horse. I think the next week we were going to start riding again. And I was breezing this horse down the backside, and it bolted into the rail. Well, back then we used to wire our irons. We didn't have them so they would come out. We would wire them up. And so this horse hit the rail, slid down the rail on his side with me. I went over, and he dragged me down the rail because my foot didn't come out of the stirrup. So he dragged me down the rail for a ways. Finally, it broke, and I came loose. Well, then I had to go to the hospital, and I had phlebitis, and I just had soft tissue damage all in my leg. So that was going to put me down for a while. Then the blood clot moved up into my hip. Well, that kept me down a lot longer than I thought.
No.
So I could not get back to it. I had to stay down for quite a bit longer because I had to keep the leg up, and it got really dangerous for a while there. So that was going to be my comeback Well, then I started thinking, okay, I can do this. So after a while, it might have been maybe 6 months later, I started getting fit, losing the weight, because I was depressed from not being able to ride and getting hurt. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to get back. I was ready to come back to the track, start riding. I had a horse go over backwards and break my pelvis.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was the end of my career there.
Yeah, broken pelvis, that's not good.
Yeah, that was a bad one because then I had a clot also move into my lung on that one. I couldn't use my legs, and when it happened, I was like, nope, I don't want anybody to know what's going on. So I just sort of bit the bullet. They had to pick me up by my arms, drag me into a car because I didn't want an ambulance. And then they couldn't get me out of the car. And then they found out it was, I thought I broke my back, but instead it was the pelvis. But it was so much damage that I couldn't walk. I couldn't do anything. That kept me down for quite a while.
How long did it take to completely recover from that?
Oh, God, that one was quite a long time because of the blood clotting factor. I kept having trouble with blood clots.
My goodness.
Gosh, I can't remember. But I know I took time off again, and this must have been a year and a half. And then I started just working at a bar, you know, to be at bartending, waitressing, trying to make some money because I knew I couldn't get on horses yet. And then I went back to Hialeah, and I started getting on horses again. And I thought, okay, maybe I can get back to this. You know, you don't know. And that's when Tom Jolly asked if I would come and be assistant trainer for him. And I thought, no, it was in the back of my mind. I'm getting back to riding. This is what I wanted to do. This was my love. I'm going to do this. So I started working for him, breaking horses, galloping, doing everything, you know, just to get fit, got my weight down. I was doing everything. Then he said, well, let's go to Tampa, and you can train the horses here at Tampa. So I took 11 horses to Tampa, and I was a trainer then. And I still had it in the back of my mind, I'm still going to ride. Well, I galloped everything of my own in the morning. I didn't let anybody get on my horses. I did real good. I won a few races, but then I had a couple horses with problems, and I told them I wanted to not let the horses run. I wanted to turn them out because they were just 3-year-olds, and we could save them. And they're like, no, you're going to run them. If you want the job, you're going to run these horses. And I'm like, okay. So I ran the one, and it was one of my favorites. And it actually had a crack, a spinal problem, and then in the race, it broke its back.
Oh.
And I'm like, that's it. I'm done. I am not training. Nobody's going to make me run a horse that I know can't make it. So I got off the track again. And then I decided to just go back to galloping and maybe trying to get fit again to ride. Well, I wasn't in touch with Brian, but I went up to Ocala, started working there at Grosse Pointe Stud. And I thought, you know, it was still in the back of my mind, I can get back to riding. I can do this. And I think I might have been 23 or at the time. And let's see, we were, the training track must have been a half mile from the barn. You had to go down a hill through the woods. So we were working these babies. And they had just given this ivermectin shot. Back then, it would cause swelling and fever, and they would faint from it. I was galloping this horse next to another exercise rider, and as we were galloping, the horse just fainted under me. Went down, flipped over, stepped in my neck, and I laid there on the track, and the guy came back. My horse was gone after it got up. And he laid me over the horse and walked me back to the barn. And I said, I think I'm hurt bad, but I'll be all right. So they helped me get back to my house, and I took I think I might have taken a whole Butte tablet for a 1,000-pound horse that night. Had somebody help me get up in the morning, drive myself to the hospital, and I had broken the wings on, I think 6 and 7 at the base of my neck. So that laid me up for quite a while.
I
kept thinking, well, maybe I'm not supposed to get back to riding.
When injury...
you know, everything was just going against me, but it had me in such a depression because all I wanted to do was ride.
So, Barbara, we only have a couple minutes left here on the show, but so many injuries, my goodness, and we can all relate, riders, for the most part, given the fact that an ambulance follows us around the track. Well, you know, right. It's dangerous. So, unfortunately, so many injuries you had to go through, and on top of the already difficult situation at times of being a woman in the sport and paving the path for the rest of us. But right. That's just, wow, so many injuries. That's incredible, Barbara. And what did you end up doing after you broke your neck, and what are you doing now? Like I said, just a couple minutes
I've
left.
I've got a training barn in Illinois with 30 stalls, and I still break and train horses. When I hit 67 last year, I said I was not going to bust any broncs anymore. I'm just going to, you know, train horses for dressage, riding horses I do. I retrain a lot of thoroughbreds for riding. So I work out here every day from about 6 until nighttime. I also work for the PDJF. We do our jockeys and jeans because I am one of the lucky ones that can still walk.
Right.
So we work for jockeys and jeans every year with our big benefit, and we do it at different racetracks through the year.
Such a great thing that is, Barbara. We also support the PDJF, and they do so much good, like you said, and like I can say, I'm fortunate I can still walk away, and you know, not all jockeys can say that. So what a great thing you do, helping the PDJF with that, and it's been so great to have you here, Barbara, and still can't keep you away from the horses. You're still out there riding, and
every day.
I love it. I'm gonna have to come up there one of these days. I'll have to go for a trail ride.
Oh, you're invited to come any time. When it starts cooling off, you'll have to come up, spend the weekend with me. I'll take you on some great rides.
That would be fantastic. That would be fantastic. Well, BJ, thank you so much for joining us and wishing you all the best in the future.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara. Now, folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, you can check out our website, horseracingradio.net. and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. You'll also find a full schedule there with all of the replays for every show we bring you here at the Horse Racing Radio Network. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dallapina, I'm Christina McManigal. Thanks for listening.